I started to notice that the very things that I was seeing in patients on the couch were occurring at a much greater macro level in society. The issues of disavowal, of exceptionalism, of we'll abandon reality if it means that we have to give something up, and so on and so forth. So I started seeing, and that was why I got so interested in this subject as an analyst, because I start and thought, you know, we have something to say about what's happening in the world.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and Off the Couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years. And have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Sally Weintraub. Sally is a fellow of the British Psychoanalytic Society with a strong focus, interest, and expertise in the presence of the climate crisis we're currently living in, which is the focus of today's conversation. We review a number of aspects of this. We start off by talking about the different mindsets with which people bring to this crisis. Sort of in parallel to the COVID crisis, there are people who approach this from a state of mind of exceptionalism, that these things don't really impact us, that there's a bubble that they live in. And then there's a more object-related state of mind where one can be reasonably concerned and attentive and deal with the crisis while also living a rich and full life. And we talk about those different states of mind. We also go into what it means to take data that we get from the couch and apply it to the culture, how that informs, how that can distract. And then we get into clinical material, which is how does one understand it when a patient comes in with concerns about the earth? How do we listen to it on a manifest level, like for any outside force, any literal outside force that someone comes to us with? We listen to it both literally and at the same time, we listen to it metaphorically. How does their concerns about Earth also include their concerns about Mother Earth and their own mothering and their own having been mothered and mothering going forward for them? And Sally makes the point very convincingly to me that by listening on both levels, by listening on the literal level of the Earth and the climate crisis that we're in, one can better listen to the latent level, to the metaphoric level, that the analytic process is best served by being attentive to both, not to ignoring one. I think it's a fascinating point and the worthwhile beginning of a longer conversation. We end by Sally sharing with us a bit about her past and growing up in South Africa and how that has contributed to her current interests. Sally is very active in a number of organizations. She is the chair of the IPA Committee on Climate Change. She lectures widely around the world on the subject. She's contributed to and edited the book Engaging with Climate Change, Psychoanalytic and Interdisciplinary Perspectives. And her current book, called Psychological Roots of the Climate Crisis, Neoliberal Exceptionalism and the Culture of Uncare, was recently published by Bloomsbury. I greatly enjoyed our conversation. I learned a lot, as I did from reading her book, and I hope you enjoy it as well. Sally, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad you're able to join us.
It's a great pleasure, Harvey. Thank you for asking me.
Sally, you have devoted yourself really to a remarkable degree to appreciating, if that's the right word, appreciating the climate calamity we are all in the midst of. And your studies have led you to conclude that there are basically two mindsets with which people approach this calamity. One we could call a mindset of exceptionalism. And as you've understood this, these are people who approach disturbing realities with more than a little bit of denial. That their attitude is, if it's disturbing, if it limits me, if it suggests frustration on my part, I'm just going to close my eyes and deny that it's there. It's sort of, they live in a bubble, and the bubble has these characteristics. There's omnipotence of thinking. The bubble doesn't have to acknowledge the passage of time and the change of time. It doesn't acknowledge separateness, that there are entities, people, important people and important entities in their life that are separate from them, that have their own needs, that have to be related to. And also key in this way of thinking is the type of pleasure that these people have. It's mostly sensation focused. It's more of an excitement than a quiet pleasure. And so that's the category of an entitled group of people, an uncaring group of people, to use one of your words. And then there's another category that we'll call an object-related group of people, where they do acknowledge limits, that time is honored, and with that is this terrible fragility that us humans have in the face of the passage of time. And with that, it allows sorrow and mourning. And is less of an idealization, because people are separate and people are real. And as I say, we're fragile. And also with that, pleasure is of a different sort. Pleasure is more of a joyful sort than an excited sort. Now, we see these individuals in our offices on a regular basis. And I do understand that nobody fits these categories purely. We all have both inside us, and we all vacillate between these two states of mind, more often than not living someplace in between them. But there is an important difference in the ratio about people who live way more in one and way more in the other. And we think of it in terms of how they relate to the objects in their lives, their partners, their children. It's often how they were related to as children by the caretakers. And of course, ultimately, we see this in the transference, how they relate to us, which is the laboratory with which we can help them learn about the way they relate. But you expand this and you say, yes, it is true for how they relate to people, but it's also true to how they relate to our world, our climate, our future. And there's great consequence, you've pointed out, for those who live in this bubble, who feel themselves to be exceptions. The way they disregard the reality and the limits of the world we're living in is having dire consequences. So I'm going to ask you to flesh this out for us, and just to mention that this then brings up a next question that we're going to get to, which is how we work in the office as psychoanalysts, how we listened to manifest content about Earth, and how we listen to latent content about Mother Earth, and how we work those two truths. But start us off, Sally. Tell us about these states of mind that you've encountered.
Well, first of all, Harvey, thank you. It's for distilling these two states of mind. And, I'm listening to you and hearing about the ideas that I've struggled to express in this book. So I feel very well understood by you. So thank you for that. I would emphasize what you yourself said, that, from a psychoanalytic perspective, we know that these states of mind are very much both inside us. You know, we follow a conflict model, after all, you know. And so that's one very important thing. And I also wanted to pick up on you're emphasizing that we find these states of mind in clinical work, which is absolutely right. And what happened with me is that I started to notice, as I'm not alone in this, I started to notice that the very things that I was seeing in patients on the couch were occurring at a much greater macro level in society. The issues of disavowal, of exceptionalism, of, you know, we'll abandon reality if it means that we have to give something up, and so on mm-hmm. and so forth. So I started seeing that, and that was why I got so interested in this subject as an analyst, because I start and thought, you know, we have something to say about what's happening in the world. And then I felt that I had to start really studying the political process, which became my data. I started to feel that my data became wider than the individual data from patients on the couch, and it became looking at government decisions, political ideologies, and I try to trace those out in the book. It very much concerns tracing out exceptionalism in recent political ideology. And it also then led me on to something else, which I think is vital, which is that an exceptionist state of mind can only maintain itself through initiating a culture, which I call the culture of uncare. It needs actively to boost uncare, boost our uncaring side, and try to limit our caring side. I got fascinated. So the engine room of the book really is about going into current media, advertising, political framing, language itself, looking at how that the culture actually encourages us to be in a bubble. And of course, being human, because we have these forces in us, we collude, but we're also massively encouraged to be in a bubble. We're deprived of information about the real state of affairs and so on and so forth. And we're encouraged to live in a way, it's a fraud bubble. And it leaves us very vulnerable, because we know that all such bubbles will collapse, because you can't really... you can't outwit reality. It's going to surf itself in
try as we might,
way or
yeah.
another. So that was the sort of trajectory of how my psychological study in the consulting room moved outwards and focused on socio-political events.
Let me ask you a question about that. And we haven't mentioned the name of the book, and I do want to, because it's a very important work. It's by Sally Weintraub, Psychological Roots of the Climate Crisis. It really cuts to the chase about what the theme is. It's when you make that leap from the consulting room to the culture at large, and when I read it and when I hear you speak of it, I'm left with two reactions. One is, yes, of course. I mean, what we observe on a micro level, of course, applies on a macro level. And speaking of denying frustration, I feel very satisfied because I have an expertise on what I hear and how I understand what happens in the consulting room. And I feel very satisfied that I am being invited by you to take that and apply it to the outside environment. And so I'm comforted by that. On the other hand, having been warned by you about such comforts, I also say, but wait a second, is this a little too easy for me? There are many, many other forces, apart from the individual conflicted forces that we are students of, that apply in the culture at large. And perhaps using your model of being humble in the face of what we don't know, that we need to listen differently to the culture at large, while acknowledging the similarities, of course, but still need to listen differently and be open and curious about how it's different, not just how it's the same from the consulting room. What do you think?
Gosh, I completely agree. And there are different strands in what you've just said, as I hear it. Let me gather myself and my thoughts. I was very chary of applying one field to a broader field because I've always, as an analyst, been very, very mindful of the discipline that we have. And I think the word discipline is not accidental. We train ourselves to try and see our field, which is a very difficult thing to do, as we know, to try and separate out what are over-selected facts, over-selected ideas. Sorry, I'm mixing it up. I'm thinking of a paper by Steiner and Britton on overvalued ideas and selected facts. It's very hard to see our data as it is. There's a methodological question about applying our ideas to social forces at large. Mm-hmm. And what I've come to think over time, I would say about the last decade, that's the main length of time I've been looking at all this in earnest, really, is that you have to see the data that you're looking at as worthy of being studied in great detail. So I'm not that keen on psychoanalysts, sort of in a rather ahistoric way, making pronouncements about the outside world in very general ways without doing that study of what it is that we're looking at. Now, we can never study it enough because we can never know enough. But I think we need to know how much we don't know.
Yes, about other that's disciplines. My point. Yes, yes.
And if I could just sort of bring in here, when I started on this book, mindful of these sorts of methodological problems, and realizing that I had to study social culture, I had to study, economics. I had to study psychosocial studies. It was very, very daunting. And I remember thinking to myself, there are two things I have to hang on to here. One is, it seemed a startling thing, but I thought it made sense and it's really helped me. One is, I must allow myself to know what I know, and I must allow myself to know what I don't know. Mm-hmm. And it may sound very obvious, but actually, I don't know if you share this, Harvey, but I think sometimes as analysts in the consulting room, we don't really take ourselves seriously enough as knowing what we do know. And also, the pitfalls I could fall into with other disciplines were just huge. So I've found myself in doing bits of research feeling very comforted when I would get to a position where I would think, oh my goodness, there is so much I don't know about this. I don't know where to start. Then I would start feeling a little bit comforted because I'd feel, well, that's probably a good thing to have arrived at that point. And also, I can't spend the rest of my life studying other disciplines. So that was a real struggle for me, actually. But I think that through that, what I was trying to do was keep my analytic mind in a sort of disciplined way, looking at areas, and you realize other areas. You realize that actually, at the end of the day, it's data that you're looking at. And then you can start, and if you go into it in enough detail, you can start seeing that it's not the same thing as if you find a piece of disavowal, and you find government operating disavowal, which they are doing most of the time, sure, unfortunately, the shape of it might be the same as the sort of disavowal that you'll find with a patient, an individual patient, but the reason for it is not necessarily at all the same. And I think that's an important difference. But it doesn't mean that we can't look at the shape.
Right, so there's similarities and differences.
Yes, so it's looking for sort of family resemblances, but always bearing in mind that just because you've understood that, you know, something's happening out there, that you've understood the mechanism from on the couch, it doesn't mean that it's there for the same reason. So I think we have to proceed very carefully and cautiously in this work.
Which is being true to your model of object-related thinking, like you say, to be aware of what we do know and be aware of what we don't know, and not find that to be crushing or not to find that to be self-esteem diminishing. It's just a truth that we have to figure out how to deal with. And I would say to anyone listening to this who might think that this book is dense and hard to get through and read, Sally has a wonderful gift to write easily. It reads like a novel, but then there are footnotes throughout the book making reference to the at times dense literature that she's drawing these conclusions from. But you don't have to refer to the footnotes because it reads so beautifully going forward. And I just want to let the reader know that.
Well, thank you, Harvey. I mean, in one way, I wrote this book because I wanted to understand the climate crisis. And I also then decided that I wanted to write it in a way that was not academic and that the ordinary reader, ordinary people could understand. And so I took a decision not to introduce any jargon.
Yes. And that's why it reads so beautifully. Yes.
And one of the things is that actually, as we all know, you get quite challenged when you don't use jargon because you suddenly realize that you don't understand the ideas that were hiding behind the jargon. You know, that was quite interesting in itself, but that was my aim with the book.
You spend time on the phrase entitlement, and you use that, as I outlined, to represent a way of thinking that is basically entitled. That is, it's not reality based. It isn't humbled. It really has an omnipotence and an arrogance to it. But true to your light touch, you're not heavy handed about this. And in fact, I want to read a couple of sentences because you talk about entitlement in two different ways. There is what you call lively entitlement, which I think anyone knowing you would be able to see how easy you come to it because it sort of, you exude that. But your phrase is, lively entitlement powers the lively self, whereas narcissistic entitlement powers the narcissistic self. Central to lively entitlement is feeling entitled to give and receive love, have freedom of thought, be respected for one's difference, have ownership of one's body. Central too is entitlement to tell and be told the truth. And I think that's such a beautiful encapsulation of, yes, of course we can all play in the world of entitlement, but there's play and there's destructiveness, and you make the difference very clear.
Well, I think what's generally happened, it's my belief that what's generally happened is that lively entitlement has taken quite a blow, particularly over the last era, you know, I'd say the last 40 years. And it does correspond with the period when our economic model, which is capitalism, sort of became much more deregulated. And you know, we were encouraged to feel much more narcissistically entitled and that we didn't have to be responsible or face limits and so on and so forth. But, you know, I want to actually bring in a paper that I read ages ago, and I started out, this was a paper I wrote for the International Journal. It was a clinically based paper on entitlement attitudes and their links with grievance and complaint. If I could just say something about that, and then I'll go back to the paper, because this really, so in a way, this work of mine now traces back to, I think, that work. I can see a continuity in it, because if you think about grievance, you set up the idea of an idealized object and you demand to be an idealized self, that's the kind of narcissistic position mm-hmm. that you're in. And when you mount the grievance, it's like you're saying to your object, be perfect again, you've let me down. You know, it's like the toddler on the street who is, as it were, king of the castle at 2 years old, and then he's in an absolute strop because the world's not meeting his wishes. We're all involved with this, you know.
Sure, sure.
So grievance wants to restore a perfect world as it was before, and it's not really interested in listening. It doesn't really want to be heard. It wants to insist that, you know, you have failed to be perfect, to see me as perfect, and I want everything restored again, and I will rail at you and I'll nurse my grievance until that happens. And I'm narcissistically entitled to have to be ideal and to have you as see me ideal. That's the sort of structure. And we see that with patients. I mean, my paper was a clinical paper. And I contrasted it with, that's where lively entitlement came in, because I thought, well, lively entitlement is more related to complaint, which, so grievance, the word comes from to inflict an injury, grievere, you know. Uh-huh. Complaint is to complainere, to cry with. And so what I was saying there was that the complainer is like the baby who cries in the hope of hearing a mother, the person who makes an appeal in the hope of being heard. You could say, you know, culturally now that's people saying, we want to breathe. We want to be heard. This is too much. We're crying, you know. Mm. It's a form of object relating. And it's, sure. But what powers it is a sense that we're entitled to be heard. We're entitled to love, and we're also entitled to be loved. That's our human entitlement. And if we're not, there's something the matter. So that was the basic structure. But if I can just go on a bit more, Harvey.
Yes, please do. This is special.
Okay. What I found, I was really helped with this by a particular paper. I hope my memory is right. I think it's 1964 by Murray on entitlement. And that paper, I imagine, was sort of sparked by, because entitlement, more the narcissistic kind, was, too much to the fore in society. Groups were feeling non-entitled and so on. But he wrote this paper where he based it, I think, on a division by, I think it was Kriegman, into narcissistic entitlement, a form of a more lively entitlement, although I develop it further, the lively side, and what he called non-entitlement. And non-entitlement always goes with narcissistic entitlement, because if you claim more than your share, you've always got to have a group that is going to be dispossessed. It's part of the thinking, and I think it's part of the trouble that we're in. You know, so that's a structure, and lively entitlement works against that. It works to restore a fairer position. It restores common ground. It's against the sort of splitting and fracturing that you need to preserve narcissistic entitlement. But what Murray did is that he brought it into the realm of the psychological, because he talked about the entitled self. And at that point, it was an object of psychological and psychoanalytic study. And he said this wonderful thing. I won't quote him right, but he said, if you look at narcissism, entitlement is crucial to narcissism. He meant narcissistic entitlement. And it provides, if you think of it as a sort of as weaving, in order for narcissism to endure and to, you know, maintain its power and its ongoingness, it must be interwoven not only with the narcissistic attitude, but with the entitlement to hold that attitude. And I remember reading that and thinking, wow, you know, that's, to me, that was really a really important insight. So that sort of strand has carried on into my current work on exceptionalism. I've sort of extended it, really. Sorry, that was a lot to say, but
not at all. No, a question that comes to mind is, when I or we encounter the narcissistic entitlement, the hyperbolic self-evaluation in the office. So often, if not regularly, one finds that that covers over the very disdain with which these people see others is obviously also functioning inside themselves, and they are desperate and frenetic. That's why the sensation focus is never ending, because they always need to keep themselves busy and superior, lest they discover this loneliness and this self-hatred and this sense of abandonment and uncared for that is inside them, which in my experience, they need to at least touch on in order to find something more object-related, something more capable of giving and receiving love. And it obviously also has a personal history to them about how they, quote, love themselves or infatuated with themselves, better said, in a way to not experience the experience of being ignored that they felt as children.
Yes, I mean, you put it very well. And you know, the way that you put it sort of makes one see the link with addictive states, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yes, it does. Yes.
And it's not really love. It's a sort of a craving that can never be satisfied.
Right, right.
Which, of course, it can't be, because if you're always wanting perfection, there's always going to be something wrong, because in the real world, you won't get it. And so it's an endless kind of, you know, and it becomes a real problem when you're living in a culture that promotes that.
Now, you see, we just did it just right there. That's a great introduction to our next theme. I was thinking when you were saying that, and what a challenge and struggle that is in the office, in the transference, when we are perfect and we're imperfect and we're in the imperfect and that. And your next thought was to go to the culture.
Yeah.
Which is a wonderful similarity and difference between us as we then take up the question of just that issue, that when patients come in and their manifest, and I'll use the word, their manifest concern is, let's say, an outside literal thing, climate. Now, obviously, there are many outside calamities. We're all still living under COVID, more or less. And so it's not that we're unfamiliar with outside literal calamities that one needs to acknowledge. But let's talk about climate. When people come in and talk about that, you make the point that we have two tasks, one of which is to listen and to hear and to recognize that what they're pointing out, like COVID, is something we are both operating under and we are both vulnerable to, and also as their analyst and as the only person in their life with the potential to help them see that there's something additional in the meaning to this manifest focus of theirs. And that is, as I said, their worry about Earth may include for them their unawareness of their feelings about Mother Earth. And by that, I'm referred to the mother they had, the mother they imagine, and then themselves as mother or father, as the case may be. How do you parse that out, both in your thinking and when you encounter a patient like this?
This is a fabulous question, and I'd like to get onto it. But before we do, I'd like just to make one point, which is that I think that this is just a belief of mine, that I think that we have two different possible roles as psychoanalysts in relation to climate. One is the one that we're going to go on to talk about, which is the one you've raised, you know, in how we approach it in our work with patients.
Yeah.
The other one is that I think that we have a more we have a role as helping people at large to understand some of these forces. So, for instance, in writing this book that I've just written, I've been writing it with that aim in mind, because I think people are there's a lot of feedback coming in, and you know, and this field is burgeoning now. That people are really looking for understanding and help that they're not mostly getting, to understand why they're so anxious. You know, what sort of forces are at work? Is their anxiety realistic, and so on? And so we can talk to people at large. Most of the time, I'm talking to groups of people. And I think that that's a very valid thing that we can be doing, and we can sure. be, you know, we can be coming out as professions and saying, look, you know, the climate emergency is causing a mental health crisis. You know, before we move on to the individual, I just wanted to say that I think, you know, we are not, I don't believe that we as analysts, that our main contribution can be to help individuals on the couch with this problem. Our main contribution. And I just wanted to sort of get a word in for that, you know, before we look at.
And I think it's a crucial point, because without that clarification, it would be easy to misunderstand your position as not being attentive to these more typical metaphoric meanings that we also attend to in the office. Because your focus on, I don't know how you feel about the activist term, which is a honorable term, certainly, or honorable way to engage with the world, it is a different way to engage than helping a particular individual understand both their outside reality and their inside reality and the tensions that exist between them, if that yes, turns out to be
indeed. And you know, and just a word on activism, you know, there's activism where you go and join a demonstration. But the activism that we're talking about here is actually through understanding and talking and writing with the aim of helping people to contain. It's a therapeutic activism, I would call it, because you're actually trying to help people contain things that can feel quite unbearable.
That's a lovely, lovely term, therapeutic activism. Did you just come up with that?
Yeah, I did.
Oh. I did. I'm writing it down. I think that's terrific.
You know, because we all discuss these things. Yeah. Okay, so talking about how should we approach?
When you have a patient, and I know you've written about this, who comes in with worries, for example, worries about having a child. What they're aware of is their worry is about the climate that this new child will be in, referring to the environmental climate, the physical climate, not the emotional climate. And they present to you struggling with the question of, should they bring new life into this world? And again, their focus is on, well, you know, given how bad the climate is in 10 years, et cetera, et cetera. How you think of it and what it means for you to create an alliance with that person. Alliance is a glib term often. I mean it to be an alliance refers to the commitment that the two individuals have together to understand in particular in a certain way the mind of one of them. That's just for me. I'm open to however you see it. But how do you approach in your mind such a patient?
Well, I had a referral like that. Could you see, let's call her Monica. She's a young woman and she wants to have a baby, but she's also, she faces the dilemma that she thinks it's irresponsible to have a baby in today's world because of the climate emergency. She wants a therapist who is climate aware. That was the actual referral. I couldn't take this patient on. So I don't know what the outcome or the interplay was with Monica, let's call her. But it's a fascinating, but I think it raises the sorts of issues yeah. that you're referring to. Mm-hmm. So I think, and let's have a conversation about this, because not a one way, you know. I mean, first of all, there are no answers, but I think that we need to. I wrote about this actually recently. This conundrum, and started with, well, first of all, you can only know what she is worried about in finding it out in the actual analytic work. Anything else would be glib.
And by analytic work, you mean what these things stand for?
Yes, in the work of receiving her communications, non-verbally, through projection, in all the ways that we struggle to understand people and learn about them, that analytic work, that tough work that we do, you know, I think that what she might mean would only emerge through that kind of work. So we can't be glib about it, but we could say that she's brought an issue that concerns a baby, a mother, and an emergency. And I would say that she identifies in a manifest way that emergency as being an emergency about the climate. And she also says that she wants to be taken seriously about this emergency. So I would be very cautious in listening to such a picture. And as I say, I wouldn't be able to come up with answers because that only comes through the work. But I would already be alerted to, okay, those are the terms. So, you know, within our frame, we would be thinking flexibly about who might be the mother, who might be the baby, what is the emergency, and what is the climate she's talking about? Is it a physical climate? Is it a human climate? You know, and I think that we would expect to find all these strands interwoven. That's the kind of work we do. Because we find external reality and internal reality usually is presented to us in an interwoven kind of form. We could well expect, given the subject matter that she's bringing, that that we will be entering the terrain of trauma. And again, the trauma is a complex thing because the state of the climate is enough to induce trauma in anyone who takes it seriously. We can say more about that, but, you know, really understanding the state that the climate is in at the moment is it's so tough to bear. And we tend to either get overwhelmed or underwhelmed by it. And we know that those two states themselves are indicative of trauma. And we're all trying to battle with that. So it's, I think we're, you know, being underwhelmed and overwhelmed. So I think we also can be alert that this is probably the area of trauma. We would also know that if we're talking about a figure who is unaware that there is a baby and an emergency, we're also, and that's a, that might be to do with projected onto the therapist. It might relate to the patient herself and her fears about, can she look after a baby? It might be her archaic objects and so on and so forth. We know that we're in a very, very complex terrain. I mean, I'll stop there for a moment and just get your reflections on what I've just said.
Well, I have an interesting reaction to hearing you. I have a smile on my face, and I get that smile often when I listen to someone who does really graceful analytic work. It just happens to be a thing that touches me deeply, always has. And added to that is a little bit of surprise. I don't know why surprise. I wasn't sure how you were going to handle the question because, you know, as you well know, you're known as the climate lady. You refer to yourself that way in various things I've read of yours. And I don't quite know what that means. I know it's a passion of yours and certainly you've thought deeply about it. But I asked myself, okay, so Sally's the climate lady, but what does she do with a case? And what you do with a case, so I learned, is just lovely analytic thinking. That's what you do with a case, which is, I was going to say, is all I need to know. It's not all I need to know. It's the first thing I need to know. And the second thing is all the other things you do besides think of a case in a way that I find lovely. And that is you take it further and you don't just stop there. You don't, I mean, the theme of this podcast is psychoanalysis on and off the couch. So it's both. And you've just shown what you do on the couch, but you also take it and you apply it off the couch in many, many ways. So that's my reaction to hearing you describe it like that.
Well, thank you. Let's take it on the couch and take it a bit, try and take it a bit further on the couch.
Okay.
What was I going to say? Because let's go back to, so I would say, and this was the point of this paper I wrote using this material, this referral material, that we need to take very seriously Monica's request for someone who is climate aware in its own terms. Because, you know, clearly at a surface level, she means aware that there is a planetary emergency going on, you know.
And that it's important to her.
And that's important to her. So she wants someone who gets that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that where I go, where I take that a bit further, is that I think it's really important to grasp that in order to understand the climate emergency, it's important to understand that we are invited into a collective bubble. I mean, all of us, I take myself absolutely mm-hmm. into this bubble, and that it is very hard to become climate aware because you've got to locate yourself socially as in a bubble, most likely, more or less, etc. You need to understand how that bubble arose. You need to do some conceptual work to be able to understand the climate problem. That's mm-hmm. one thing. And I have always found that that work is clarifying it. It's funny. Sometimes intellectual understanding can be containing of anxiety in its own right, you know. But sure. you need to do all that work because this is an anxiety-inducing subject because we cannot talk about losing, our very foundation, the earth that provides us with everything, without anxiety. And then we need to expose ourselves to and seek out real news about the climate. And I believe that we're faced, if I could just say a bit more about this, that the kind of work we need to be able to be a person who would meet the criteria that Monica has asked for, someone who's climate aware. It does not mean that someone's aware that there's a problem with the climate. It involves the same level of taking something in as we would apply to any other area in our work. And it's hard work. And, it can leave us feeling quite dispirited, just like the climate scientists. You know, they're really struggling, actually, and sure. they feel not heard. And, and then I think that this is really an aspect of someone like Monica's problem, that she's worried that she'll come to an analyst who might make sort of lip service interpretations to say, you know, you've raised in this session, you've raised the state of the climate and you're worried about that. But she will hear the difference mm-hmm. if the empathy is not in the voice of her analyst. And she will feel abandoned in the same way that maybe a black patient might feel abandoned by a white analyst who doesn't understand about structural racism, doesn't understand how it really feels to have a black skin in a racist society, you know.
Or doesn't know that they don't know.
And doesn't, and this is so important, Harvey. This is the crux of it, because the bubble means, the bubble's very effective because you don't know you're in a bubble.
Right.
And so I'm suggesting, and you could say the same thing about a woman who's seeing a male analyst who doesn't really understand what sexism feels like and doesn't know that they don't understand. So, and I love your way of putting that because that gets to the heart of the matter. And so I'm saying that to take this really seriously, we have to be willing to do some study about the problem. We have to be humble enough to admit that, you know, that the culture will be affecting us just as much as anyone else. We all love to say, you know, look at everybody else. They're so drawn in by the culture. Look at the state. And we don't realize that actually we're drawn in too.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Is it fair to summarize, because I don't want to lack nuance to it, but to summarize to say that one will be a better analyst to discovering the hidden meanings if one takes seriously and also literally the outer meanings that are on someone's mind.
Absolutely. And no, it's a very good summary. And when you talk about hidden meanings, it puts me in mind of something else, which is that, let me just sidetrack a bit. I have a colleague who's works on eco-anxiety with children and teenagers, and which is a big subject at the moment. And a group of them asked her to come and talk to them at their school about this subject, and they all got talking, and they said they can't talk to their parents. Because if they try and tell their parents how anxious they are about the state of the planet, they'll be shut down in one way or another. And so it was a welcome relief to have someone who will take them seriously. So, you know, with that kind of framework, I think, again, if we go back to the trauma framework, we know that people who feel traumatized, and the phrase at the moment is eco-trauma, you know, and people are feeling it, that they might, but trauma in general, actually, they find it, they're very tentative. It's like coming out of a shell, you know, to test the water, to see, well, if I make a vague sideways reference to this subject, will I be picked up and heard? And actually, interestingly, I've heard Fakhri Davids who's working on race, you know, is a colleague of mine in the British Society, who says the same thing applies with black patients, particularly with white analysts. They'll make some veiled reference to how they're feeling, and they'll be listening out. Does my analyst actually, are they sensitive to this subject? Are they really listening to how I'm feeling? And they'll be very quick to withdraw. So this applies to climate as well. So what I'm saying is that I think to be aware of climate as an analyst would inevitably involve us in very, very painful, anxiety-provoking, shocking work, you know, coming out of this bubble. And to add that we know about bubbles, if we take them as collective psychic retreats, and I'm using that word psychic retreat in its analytic sense now and extending it, we know that we face a series of shocks because the bubble is designed to protect us from our anxieties and our guilt and our soul and so forth, you know. And when we come out of the bubble, we can expect to be exposed to these things. So we need to come out of the bubble sufficiently to be able to really meet our patients in this area.
Sally, let me ask you about you. You both care so deeply and think so deeply about this. Can you give us a sense of who you are and how you got to this place in your life?
At one level, one never really knows, does one?
I know that, yeah.
Yeah. But you said you were going to be asking me this, and I left it till the last minute. But then I realized, what I thought was, there are four figures in my life who have been very important and I think have guided me. And they are my paternal grandparents who lived on a farm in South Africa and who I spent quite a lot of time with, and my parents. And I would say, putting it very sort of crudely and simply, but I mean it, my grandparents, my grandfather in particular, really opened up my love of nature. You know, I would walk down with him. It was quite a small mixed dairy farm in Natal in South Africa, and I would walk down with him early in the morning to the cows, and there was cow milking and so on. And he would be calling out the birds, and it was just lovely. And so I owe him a lot. And the same with my grandmother, and just a sense of her division into, you had time for you that was fun and you had time that was helping, which was also fun, actually. And also she had a tremendous respect for the natural world as well. So helping involved going to pick up the eggs from the chickens and things like that, and helping her tie up flowers for the market. This sort of, I mean, to me, it was great fun, but you had to do helping as well. So there was that framework. And then my parents, both doctors in South Africa, and political, fought apartheid, did their first job as running the health centre with another couple who were doctors from Wits, qualified out of Wits, and running the Alexandra Health Clinic, where I lived until I was 7 years old. I lived in the staff quarters in the health clinic of Alexandra Township, which is the other big township in Johannesburg, like Soweto. So this was a very, very rich background to be informed about politics. And if I could say one more thing, on the farm, I've thought about this all my life, because the farm was on, as it were, virgin land, which was not. It had displaced the Africans who had been living on the land, who lived like two hills further away. And, you know, I was born into that unequal structure.
With hidden meanings.
With hidden meanings. All its viciousness, actually. Mm. I'd be sitting up an orange tree, eating oranges to my heart's content. I used to spend like half a day up the orange tree. Meanwhile, we had two orange orchards, and black kids, makes me want to cry, actually, black kids would be hit if they tried to steal oranges. This is the world that I was brought up in. So, you know, and it's taken me my whole lifetime to sort of think about that, and I'll go on thinking about it. It was very brutal. And however, I think that, you know, the things that interest me in my life, and also some sort of fortitude that my parents showed in that situation, because they did take on the system, both of them, and, you know, has been tremendously important to me.
Sally, I regret, well, you know, speaking of, we have to honor limits. Unfortunately, one of the limits we have to honor is time. I want to thank you on many levels. Thank you for your work, and speaking for myself and the education I received in reading your work. Thank you for your spirit in the face of this work. Let me just read a sentence or two from your book, where you say, quote, "We need to keep both hopeful dreams and nightmare scenarios in mind if we are to build a world that can support life and is sustainable. We also need the strength and the will that come from having a strong sense of entitlement to life." So while you are painfully aware of the calamities we are facing, you really do carry forth the spirit that you mentioned from your grandmother, which is of having fun, of being helping, and of being attuned to the natural world. And I would add also, by your life's work and your parents' work, being aware of the politics of having fun and of helping and of being attuned to the natural world. Sally, it's been fun for me. I hope our listeners enjoyed it as much as I think you and I did. And I want to thank you for spending time and for educating us as you have. I appreciate it.
I've enjoyed this hugely, Harvey. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.